I was thinking about Sparta the other day, and it occurred to me that it has a small population, but obviously it's the most powerful and well-renowned city-state in Greece. So I started questioning myself as to how this situation might have come about. Then, when I considered the legal institutions of the Spartans, I had my answer. It was Lycurgus who gave the Spartans the laws they obey. Lycurgus did not copy or imitate the laws of other city-states. He devised a new legal code that was completely different from other states. And it is this system that has made his country and his people supremely successful. Other Greek parents sent their boys to a school to learn writing and music. These boys, however, are indulged by giving them soft sandals, comfortable clothing, and as much food as they can eat. Spartan boys do not have their feet softened by wearing sandals. Lycurgus instructed that the boys should go barefoot to harden their feet. He believed that a barefoot youth would learn to leap, jump, and run faster than any boy encumbered by sandals. This practice of going barefoot would also allow youths to easily climb hills and descend steep slopes without the risk of injury. Lycurgus also did not allow Spartan youths to be spoilt by excessive clothes. Indeed, he introduced the custom of wearing one single style of outfit throughout the year. He thought that this habit would prepare the citizen to withstand seasonal changes in heat and cold, extremes experienced on military campaigns. Regarding their diet, Lycurgus required the officials to provide enough food to sustain the boys, but never allowed them to fully satisfy their hunger. He believed that those who trained and exercised under these conditions would be better able to work on an empty stomach. Consequently, if a command was given on campaign, then adult Spartans would be better able to undergo scarcities of supplies. They could eat whatever was available and still retain good health and endurance. Lycurgus also thought that a diet that kept the body slim would increase height and build better than by eating fattening foods. But Lycurgus was also concerned that the boys might experience too much hunger. He therefore allowed them to alleviate this by stealing food. The purpose of this practice is obvious to everyone. He gave the boys a difficult challenge that encouraged resourcefulness. A person plotting theft will spend restless nights planning the action. He must disguise his intent, recruit observant accomplices, lookouts, and informants, and await his opportunity for his planned enterprise. It is certain that Lycurgus devised this system to make the boys more ingenious in procuring supplies as further preparation for combat. Of course, someone might ask, if the Spartans endorse theft, then why is the boy who is caught thieving beaten as punishment? I reply, because a learner must be punished for not properly conducting the task he is being taught to perform. So the Spartans punish those who get caught because they were stealing badly. I must begin with the origin of the state, which derives from the production of children. In other city-states, girls are destined to become mothers and are brought up in the traditional ways. They are only allowed a simple existence with limited access to any extra consumables or even luxuries. They are denied wine, or else their drink is diluted with water, reducing its effect. Greeks expect their girls to sit about and be less active and more withdrawn than males. They imagine that women raised in this manner will be content to work quietly within the household, doing the task of woolworking or other handicrafts. But how can we expect women brought up in this manner to give birth to superior children? Lycurgus thought that the labor of slave women would be sufficient to supply enough clothing and perform any other household craft work. He believed that motherhood was the most important function of freeborn citizen women. Therefore, his prime dictate was that females should undergo as much physical training for this role as men do for theirs. So he established athletic races and trials of fitness for women competitors. For Lycurgus believed that if both parents are powerful and energetic people, they will produce stronger offspring. In addition to this, he withdrew a man's right to take a wife whenever he chooses to do so. His directives ensured that men marry when they are in their physical prime, as this increases the production of the healthiest children. If a man is impeded by old age or infirmity, another male, in good mental and physical strength, can procreate on his behalf. Likewise, if a wife is unable to produce healthy children, then a man can seek a surrogate, providing her husband consented. These offspring would be brothers, but with no claim on property. So Lycurgus imposed regulations regarding the breeding of children that were very different from the other city-states. By this means, he successfully populated Sparta with a race of men who are superior in size and strength. Anyone who wants to see this can inspect the Spartans and judge the result for themselves. If a man is attracted by the physical form of a boy, that connection is banned, as it is an abomination. This prohibition has prevented the practice. It is as rare as incestual intercourse with children or sexual relations between brothers and sisters. I'm not surprised that other Greeks refuse to believe this statement, for their laws do not oppose this behavior. This is the Spartan system of education, and I've explained how it differs from that of other Greek city-states. Others can easily judge which system produces the more obedient, respectful, and self-controlled citizens. Lycurgus was concerned that when their warden was absent, the boys would have no ruler. He therefore gave the authority to any Spartan citizen who happened to be nearby. He granted them powers to command the boys to perform some action or punish them for misconduct. This made the boys more respectful of authority. Lycurgus insisted that Spartan youths walk in silence and keep their hands concealed beneath their cloaks. They must keep their eyes fixed on the ground and not look directly at adult citizens. These rules have proven that a humble condition when practiced by males can even exceed the modesty expected from women. Indeed, I would expect a stone statue to speak before I could hear an outburst from a Spartan youth. I think it would be easier to attract the attention of a bronze figure. Indeed, Lycurgus believed that if he could get young men to compete against each other to achieve certain positions, then everyone might gain a higher level of masculine prowess. I will explain how he encouraged this competition. This struggle is most highly prized by the gods. Each competitor strives for superiority with all their personal might, so by these means they support and enhance the city-state. I've described the codes that Lycurgus imposed to regulate the successive stages of citizen life. I will now describe the system he established for all adult citizens. Lycurgus established customs at Sparta that are different from other Greek communities. In other city-states, men try to make as much money as they can. Some citizens are farmers, others are shipowners or merchants, or they practice different craft skills. But in Sparta, Lycurgus forbade freeborn citizens to have any involvement in these businesses. He insisted that Spartan citizens concern themselves only with activities that guaranteed their political power and independence: the conduct of war. His measures ensured that all citizens had a similar standard of living, regulated meals, and the food supply was collected from equal contributions in the dining clubs. So this eliminated the attraction of wealth for the sake of indulgence. There is also no temptation to gain wealth to spend on expensive garments. Men are not judged on their clothing, but by the excellence of their physique. A man might amass wealth to spend on his dining comrades, but he receives more respect from personal effort and performance than could be gained from material offerings. Lycurgus also introduced other measures to make it impossible for Spartans to make money by unfair means. Firstly, he established a system of coinage involving heavy iron bars. Even a sum as small as 10 minae could not be moved into a household without the master and his servants being aware of the transaction. A large sum of this money would fill a room and require a wagon for transport. Furthermore, Sparta has regulations permitting property searches, and if gold and silver were discovered on a premises, then a fine was imposed. Money-making was therefore eliminated as the main preoccupation of the city-state. Lycurgus found the Spartans living in family households, like the other Greeks, but he considered that these private spaces limited the full cohesion of society. He therefore established dining areas for the Spartans in places exposed to public view. The food offered at these dining places is always sufficient to ensure that the citizen does not receive too much or too little. Lycurgus also abolished the practice of compulsory drinking, the custom of refilling a cup passed down a line of guests. He thought that this practice destroyed both the body and the mind. Instead, he instructed that every person was to have their own cup and drink only when they wanted to. Lycurgus believed that this was the least harmful and most rewarding way to consume wine. These public dining places also removed the possibility that men might ruin their fortunes and family inheritances by providing feasts full of gluttonous foods and overabundant drinks. Lycurgus also observed the impact that rations had on workers. A man who works hard due to his duties or personal character will have a superior physique. He therefore required the senior instructor in every gymnasium to set activities appropriate to the food portions being consumed. Their training exercises equally enhanced their legs, arms, and necks. I personally believe that Lycurgus succeeded in this measure, for the Spartans are clearly the healthiest and most robust of all men. Spartan institutions differ in other ways from ordinary Greek practices. In most city-states, each man has control of his own children, servants, and goods. But Lycurgus wanted to guarantee that all citizens had a common unity and gained advantage from each other. He therefore gave every father authority over other men's children. When fathers have this authority, they will treat other children as they expect their own to be treated. Indeed, it is considered a disgrace if a son complains to his father after being beaten by another boy's father. The son is quite likely to receive another beating. A similar scheme existed for horses, and if a citizen falls ill or needs to reach somewhere quickly, he is permitted to borrow a horse from anywhere he finds it. Lycurgus contrived many excellent plans to make the citizens willingly obey his laws, but one of his most ingenious was to take his legal code to Delphi, the religious center of the Greek world, before presenting it to the Spartan populace. Lycurgus arrived at Delphi accompanied by the most important Spartan citizens and formally posed his question to the god Apollo. He asked the god if it was better for Sparta to follow his new constitution and obey the laws he had devised. When the god answered that this constitution benefited Sparta in every way, Lycurgus returned to his homeland and presented his laws to the populace. But he also informed them that anyone who refused the judgment of Apollo, as revealed by the Pythian oracle, would be guilty of sacrilege. Another achievement of Lycurgus deserves admiration. He made his people prefer an honorable death in battle to a disgraceful life as a coward avoiding combat. This is a benefit because the Spartans lose a smaller proportion of their men by standing firm in combat rather than fleeing from danger. It seems soldiers generally avoid death on the battlefield by displaying valor rather than cowardice. Bravery is a great incentive for men on the battlefield, making them stronger and more resourceful. And obviously, glory comes from valor, so all men seek it. Lycurgus ensured that the brave would be granted happiness and the coward subjected to misery. But I must explain his methods. In other Greek city-states, a proven coward only suffers the consequence of being called a coward. He goes to the same market as the brave man and sits beside him. He may even choose to attend the same gymnasium. But every Spartan would be ashamed to have a coward with him in the dining place or matched against him in a wrestling bout. When sides are chosen for sport and athletic contests, the coward is always excluded. He is ousted from the chorus and allocated a place of shame at religious gatherings. He must give up his seat at any event, even to a junior citizen. He is ranked among the unmarried women and assigned a household role to join in their discussions about the lack of husbands. He will be denied a wife and not obtain any benefits from this. For if he strolls around looking relaxed, like a man without concerns, he will be set upon and beaten by his betters. So much dishonor is loaded upon these cowards that death seems preferable. These law codes seem to appear strange and antiquated to other Greeks, for although they recognize these practices and praise the institutions, no other state will implement them. The advantages I have outlined benefit a state during peacetime and in war. but I can also explain how the measures introduced by Lycurgus improved the Spartan military organization and made it superior to all other systems. The honors bestowed on a king in his own homeland do not greatly exceed those enjoyed by an ordinary citizen. This was intentional, since Lycurgus wanted to prevent any king from feeling despotic pride or cause the citizens to envy him when observing his royal entitlements. But the laws of Lycurgus do reveal true reverence for kings in their funeral rites. This is the only instance when the kings of the Spartans are honored, not as mere men, but as virtual demigods. When war is declared, the council issues a proclamation stating the fixed age limit for a levy of troops. First, they recruit the horsemen and hoplites. Then they determine the need for men with specific craft skills, and they fill those roles. This means that, when on campaign, the army are well supplied with all the useful materials and skills they require. All the implements and weapons that the army needs are assembled prior to the campaign. Lycurgus arranged for the soldiers to wear a red military cloak, as this clothing was considered to be the most masculine outfit and least like garments worn by women. Lycurgus allowed the younger men to wear their hair long as it enhanced their physique, making them appear taller and more terrifying. The dominant opinion is that Spartan infantry formations are very complex, but this is incorrect. Their formations are easy to organize so that no man who is following the movement of his comrades can make any mistake. Some soldiers have the privilege of leading the ranks, and the rest simply follow orders. Their law also requires all Spartans to practice regular gymnastic exercises on campaign. This bolsters their pride and allows them to demonstrate their physical prowess. Their race courses are always within the regimental space, so that no man is ever far from his weapons as he exercises. Before battle, an order is given for the soldiers to polish their military kit. It is also a custom for the young warriors to comb and dress their hair before combat. Then they are reminded of their obligations and expected to be boisterous. The men then shout encouragements to their officers. Anyone viewing these arrangements must certainly think that all other Greek soldiers are amateurs, merely improvising their tasks. Only the Spartans are the true artisans and masters of warfare. The Greeks that awaited the Persians in that place were these. Of the Spartans, 300 men-at-arms, 1,000 Tegeans and Mantineans, from Orchomenus in Arcadia, 120, and 1,000 from the rest of Arcadia. Besides these Arcadians, 400 from Corinth, 200 from Phlius, and 80 Mycenaeans. From Boeotia, 700 Thespians and 400 Thebans. All these had their generals, each city its own, but he that was most regarded and was leader of the whole army was Leonidas of Lacedaemon. These, the men with Leonidas, were sent before the rest by the Spartans, that by the sight of them the rest of the allies might be moved to arm and not, like the others, take the Persian part. Such had been their intent, but the Greeks at Thermopylae, whom the Persian drew near to the entrance of the pass, began to lose heart and debate whether to quit their post or no. Leonidas gave his vote for remaining where they were and sending messages to the cities to demand aid, seeing that he and his were too few to beat off the Median host. While they thus debated, Xerxes sent a mounted watcher to see how many they were and what they had in hand. The horseman rode up to the camp and viewed and overlooked it. There he saw some of the men at exercise and others combing their hair. Marveling at the sight and taking exact note of their numbers, he rode back unmolested, none pursuing nor at all regarding him, so he returned and told Xerxes all that he had seen. When Xerxes heard that, he could not understand the truth, namely that the Lacedaemonians were preparing to slay to the best of their power or be slain. What they did appeared to him laughable, therefore he sent for Demaratus, the son of Ariston, who was in his camp, and when he came questioned him of all these matters, that he might understand what it was that the Lacedaemonians were about. "I've told you already," said Demaratus, "of these men when we were setting out for Hellas, but when you heard, you mocked me. Now hear me once more. These men are come to fight with us for the passage, and for that they are preparing, for it is their custom to dress their hair whensoever they are about to put their lives in jeopardy. Moreover, I tell you that if you overcome these and what remains behind at Sparta, there is no other nation among men, O king, that will abide and withstand you. Now are you face to face with the noblest royalty and city and the most valiant men in Hellas. Xerxes deemed what was said to be wholly incredible, and further inquired of him how they would fight against his army, being so few. O king, Demaratus answered, call me a liar if the event of this be not what I tell you. Yet for all that, Xerxes would not believe him. For the space of 4 days the king waited, ever expecting that the Greeks would take to flight. But on the fifth, seeing them not withdrawing, and deeming that their remaining there was but shamelessness and folly, he was angered. The Greeks at Thermopylae were warned first by Magistius the seer, who, having examined the offerings, advised them of the death that awaited them in the morning, and presently there were deserters. Thereupon the Greeks held a council, and their opinions were divided, some advising that they should not leave their post, and some disagreeing, and presently they parted asunder, these taking their departure and dispersing each to their own cities, and those resolving to remain where they were, with Leonidas. It is said indeed that Leonidas himself sent them away, desiring in his care for them to save their lives, but deeming it unseemly for himself and the Spartans to desert their post, which they had first come to defend. And so Xerxes, having at sunrise offered libations, made his assault. The foreigners that were with Xerxes attacked, but the Greeks with Leonidas, knowing that they went to their death, now met their enemies outside the narrows, and many of the foreigners were there slain, for their captains came behind the companies with scourges and drove all the men forward with lashes. Many of them were thrust into the sea and there drowned, but more by far were trodden down bodily by each other, none regarding who it was that perished, for inasmuch as the Greeks knew that they must die by the hands of those who came round the mountain, they put forth the very utmost of their strength against the foreigners in their recklessness and frenzy. By this time the spears of most of them were broken, and they were slaying the Persians with their swords. There in that travail fell Leonidas, fighting most gallantly, and with him other famous Spartans. So two brothers of Xerxes fell there in the battle, and there was a great struggle between the Persians and the Lacedaemonians over Leonidas's body, till the Greeks of their valor dragged it away, and 4 times put their enemies to flight. They defended themselves with their swords, as many as yet had such, and then with fists and teeth, till the foreigners overwhelmed them with missile weapons. Thus did the men of Lacedaemon and Thespiae bear themselves. Yet the bravest of them all, it is said, was Dionysus, a Spartan of whom a certain saying is reported. Before they joined battle with the Medes, it was told Dionysus that the enemies were so many that when they shot with their bows, the sun was hidden by the multitude of arrows. But being in no way dismayed by this, Dionysus said, "You bring us good news, for if the Medes hide the sun, we shall fight them in the shade." All these, and they that had died before any had departed at Leonidas's bidding, were buried where they fell. And there is an inscription over them, which is this: 4,000 warriors, flower of Pelops' land, did here against 300 myriads stand. This is the inscription common to all. The Spartans, however, have one for themselves. Go tell the Spartans, thou that passest by, that here, obedient to their words, we lie. Now I'm sure you will ask me if the laws of Lycurgus are still observed without change in our own era. Well, I cannot answer this question with any confidence. I know that it was once forbidden for Spartan citizens to live overseas due to the demoralizing effect of foreign contact. Spartans preferred to remain in their home communities, satisfied with modest prosperity. But now they are governors, independent city-states, and subject to all the corrupting influences of flattery and bribery. In former times, they were afraid to be found in possession of gold, but now they are boastful of such belongings. In fact, it is a popular ambition of many leading Spartans to spend the rest of their lives outside their homeland as governors or administrators of some wealthy foreign territory. In the past, Spartan leaders strove to be worthy of high office within their state, but now they shamefully conspire to claim positions of power in outside communities. The Greeks used to come to Sparta begging the state to lead them against reputed wrongdoers, but now many Greeks are calling upon one another to oppose any revival of Spartan supremacy. I am not surprised that these criticisms are being directed at the Spartans. It is clear that they no longer obey or manifest the will of their gods and the laws of Lycurgus.